The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, I wonder if you saw this photo recently of the traffic jam at the summit of Mount Everest. You know, I want to ask you the question, why has summiting Mount Everest become so popular? I think I can understand it, actually. To be literally on top of the world. I mean, imagine that selfie up there with nothing behind you but blue sky. I'm very attracted to the idea of doing extreme things and, you know, reaching the top of the world, aren't you? I mean, to run the marathon or the ultra marathon, to ride the Tour de France, or to be on the top of your chosen career. I mean, don't you want to leave your mark, to have a legacy, to be noteworthy? I do. I mean, you know, why do so many of us get involved in heavy-duty sports or risky adventures, particularly when we hit middle age? I mean, we don't want to fizzle out, do we? We want to go out in a blaze of glory. I fully get wanting to do extreme things, like going for 2 hours without coffee or not washing my keep cup, ever. Actually, 21 years ago, just before the birth of my first daughter, I thought I'd run the Sea to Surf. Now, for you marathon runners out there, like Lachlan, I know this is lame, but you know, for me it was a big deal. Okay, I admit I didn't train, apart from running for the train, but on that run, I hurt my knee in a way that I've never been able to run properly since, so much for glory. And then in this last holidays, I went surfing. You know, and I only started surfing when I was in high school, so I was never going to be any good, but I thought, here's a bit of a challenge. It was surf, it was big, actually. It was massive. So I went off the rocks, you know, my heart was beating, the adrenaline pumping through my veins. And then this massive set of waves came. I mean, they're like the top of those windows there. And I got completely smashed. I couldn't get out the back. I couldn't get in. I was near the rocks. I kept on going under. Eventually, I got washed in on the beach like some kind of beached whale, and I lay there blubbering. So much for my glorious surf. And the kind of humiliating thing is that even the most glorious thing I did in my 20s, which was to bungee jump in New Zealand, I mean, it was glorious, you know. I was on this kind of bridge, and I just did this massive swan dive into the blue yonder and just, you know, came rushing up to the river, and my eyes were sort of like hanging out like organ stops. I went to my doctor last year, and he told me my retina was bleeding. And then he began to ask me, what have you been doing? And I was too ashamed to say that I'd been bungee jumping. So, you look, I fully get this desire for glory, right? And I want to ask the question, though, you know, but where should I find it? Which road should I take? And is the cost worth it? Because it can become pretty expensive. I mean, take this guy, right? Elias Akali. He's actually climbed Everest 3 times. Cost you $100,000 a pop, right? So he's made a lot of money, or I don't know where he got the money from. But he actually made a comment about the slow shuffle to the summit of Mount Everest on the 26th of May, which I think is when that photo was taken. And this is what he told ABC News. He said, it was the sheer number of bodies we had to pass. On the way to Camp 4, there were 2 deceased climbers attached to the side of the trail, awaiting evacuation. And within 20 minutes, we came across another lifeless body that was just being brought down. 3 hours into it, the fifth body, and just beneath the Hillary Step, which I think is just the little hummock before the summit, the sixth. He said, you've got to ask yourself, what is going wrong here? Every single person that was attached to the summit that day had to step over that human being. It's devastating. Well, there's got to be a better way, hasn't there? Show me the road to glory where I don't have to step over dead bodies to get there. Well, I want to say today that the great thing is that we do have such a guide. And the name of this unlikely guide is Mary. And let me tell you her story. We first meet Mary as the grieving sister of the tomb-bound Lazarus in the chapter of the Bible just before the one that Lachlan read for us earlier. You know, she's totally beside herself, totally grief-stricken at the untimely death of her brother, understandably so. But of course, everything changes when Jesus strides up to the tomb and powerfully calls out to Lazarus and brings him out, grave clothes on and everything. So Mary and with her friends and relations would have just been absolutely awestruck at the power of Jesus. And then we meet Mary again at this dinner party given in the honour of Jesus after this mind-boggling event. You can see the story there. Pick it up in verse 1. It's on the screen or in your sheets. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus has raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honour. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Well, the scene is set. It's most likely a Saturday night, and there was probably a good-sized crowd in the house that night. The guest of honour is, of course, Jesus. And if any of the guests actually doubted his greatness, they only need to look a little bit down the line, and there was the man who'd lain rotting in the tomb days before, sitting there, having his olive dip or whatever was on the menu for that night. But actually, all eyes weren't on him. It was what happens next that really gripped the writer of this account. Verse 3, have a look at it there. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Well, did you catch what's going on here? You're at this dinner party, you're in your best toga in true Roman style, and then this beautiful fragrance just fills the whole room. It's so beautiful, it almost overwhelms you. And then you stop and stare. Mary kneels down and pours this perfume over Jesus. Oh my goodness, she's unbound her hair. She's untied it. And she's wiping Jesus' feet with her hair. Can you imagine being there? Well, what's going on here? I want you to have a look at the screen. So great is Jesus to Mary that she places her whole life at his feet. And in so doing, discovers the only true road to glory. So I want us to think about these two things in the next few minutes. Let's firstly consider the greatness of Jesus to Mary. I think if we'd been there, probably the first thing that would have struck us that night is the outlandish cost of Mary's act. There's a few accountants out there, isn't there? You know, I think it's the financial cost, but also the social cost. I mean, we read that she poured out nard. You know, nard was the essence of a plant grown from India, beautiful perfume. And it's pure nard. There's no dross in it, right? Just the genuine article. And there's a pint of it. It's almost half a litre. It's a massive amount. It cost a pretty penny. In fact, it was a small fortune. We discover in verse 5 that it was worth a year's wages, say $80,000, splashed out in a few moments. I mean, who does that? Who blows $80,000 in a night? I mean, some of the bankers that you might happen to know might do that with their clients' money and then just say, oh, it was difficult, you know, financial conditions and a less than optimal result. But I mean, who does that? It's not just the physical cost that Mary cheerfully paid. Did you notice? I think even more mind-boggling was the social cost that Mary took on willingly. We're told that, you know, she actually wipes Jesus' feet. Now, washing of the feet was the job reserved for the lowest of the low slaves. In the very next chapter, we find that Peter refuses to have Jesus wash his feet. So low and demeaning was the task. But as if washing the grimy feet of guests wasn't bad enough, Mary does it with her hair. And this makes the act all the more striking because according to Jewish sources, an upright Jewish lady would never unbind her hair in public. It was apparently a mark of loose morals. But Mary didn't stop to calculate the public reaction. Her heart went out to her Lord. I mean, she had just seen Jesus raise her brother from the dead. In a way that, yes, prefigured Jesus' own death and resurrection, in a way that perhaps Mary only dimly recognised or foresaw. But what is really going on here? Well, so impressed with Jesus is Mary that she places her whole life at his feet. She so clearly gets the greatness of Jesus that she falls at his feet in worship, and in so doing discovers the only sure road to glory. But did you notice? Not everyone agreed. Not so with Judas. his actions actually show that he's diametrically opposed to Mary. Have a look at verse 4. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself what was put into it. So not everyone reacted to Jesus as Mary did. You know, the house was filled with fragrance, as we know, from this act of Mary, but that perfume really got up the nose of one bloke at least, Judas. Now, we're told that he was keeper of the money box. Literally, he was lifter of the money box, and as lifter, he would lift money for himself to line his own pockets. And his protest at the extravagant waste of money was presented as concern for the poor. "Why," he cried, "wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor?" Yeah? You know, it seems like a noble and altruistic objection. It would align with our corporate values, I'm sure, but it masked a personal greed and a deep dissatisfaction with Jesus. Judas seems to know nothing of the extravagant devotion that Mary has just displayed. You know, Judas found his dubious agenda clashing with the cross-bound focus of Jesus. And actually, as an aside, in Mark's Gospel, we discover that this is the event that precipitates Judas agreeing to hand Jesus over for 30 pieces of silver. So what is Jesus' take on this incredible night? I mean, is Mary's act a bit OTT, you know? Is Judas' concern for the poor laudable in any way? Well, we're not left in the dark because Jesus gives us his assessment incredibly clearly in verse 7 and in so doing reveals the only sure road to glory. Have a look at it there. "Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." So focused is Jesus on his forthcoming death that he sees Mary's act as anointing him for burial. Now, her act actually had greater significance than she realized. But notice that Jesus speaks of himself as already being dead. He doesn't say, "She did this act to prepare for my death." He says, "She did this act to prepare for my burial." After death comes burial. The tradition, as you know, was to take spices and anoint the body with them. And John tells us in chapter 19 that that's precisely what Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus did. You have a look at the screen if you want to pick up the story. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. You can read the rest of the story for yourself later on. But what's incredible is that these two men took the incredibly risky, the great risk of going to Pilate to ask for the body of Jesus. Jesus was a dead Messiah. He was a nothing. We already know that the Jewish authorities had said anyone who follows Jesus will be put out of the synagogue. So not only are they risking their whole community, they're risking their jobs. We're told that Joseph of Arimathea was actually on the ruling council, perhaps the Sanhedrin. If they identify with Jesus, they're going to lose the lot. But they still do this. They abandon the cost to go and identify with Jesus. So what does this all mean for our road to glory, our own personal road to glory? Well, I guess that there are most likely two groups amongst us this afternoon, those who follow Jesus and those who are still checking it out. For those not yet following Jesus, can I say thank you so much for being here? And the first thing I actually want to say to you is that this is not everything about the cost or about the road to glory. Lachlan's asked me to speak for the next 2 weeks, so please come back. Please come back again and listen in. But I do want to raise with you something, and that is, can I ask you to ponder the cost that perhaps you are already paying in your quest for glory, whatever your Everest happens to be? I mean, remember this guy, our Canadian adventurer. Remember what he said? He said, every single person attached to the summit had to step over that human beam. It's devastating, he said. I guess, what have we had to step over to get where we are? There's a friend of mine who I've got to know, and he told me about a job he was doing the last 6 months of last year. It was incredibly full-on job. He had to get literally the first bus into town in the morning and the last bus home at night for 6 months straight. One night he came home and he saw this envelope on his kitchen table. And he opened it up and it was a letter from his daughter and it said, "Dear Daddy, when will we get to see you? I love you." Thing was, that actually that was the second night. He didn't see it the first night when the daughter had left it there. So I guess I want us to consider, you know, is your Everest worth it? And will it last? I mean, what happens when you get there? When you get the dream job or the dream relationship or the dream house, what then? I mean, apparently, when they look at the statistics of the fatalities on Mount Everest, there's a very high proportion that occur after the summit, on the way down. Concentration slips, exhaustion sets in, and so on. But that's an issue, isn't it? What are you going to do then? And I want to ask, you know, is what you're living for worthy of your wholehearted devotion? We have to worship something. Is it worth it? We've got to be obsessed about something. Is it worth it? Now, for those who do follow Jesus, may I ask you to consider what it would look like in your life for you to be like Mary, to wholeheartedly, boots and all, commit to following Jesus regardless of financial and social cost. I mean, how great do you reckon Jesus is? And what do you reckon he's worth giving up? I hope that you've been encouraged by Mary's story to see that the road to glory is actually to give up. Actually, to stop seeking glory for yourself and to honour Jesus with your whole life. We'll see in 2 weeks that Jesus actually puts it more starkly. He says that whoever loves his life will lose it, while the one who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. You know, paradoxically, if you give up serving yourself, Jesus says, "My Father will honour the one who serves me." You know, to get glory and honour, you've actually got to forget yourself and honour Jesus. And then, breathtakingly, you will be honoured on that final day. I mean, don't you think it's extraordinary that, you know, 2,000 years later, we're still talking about this Lady Mary? I mean, do you think she would have had the curliest clue that that's what we would be doing 2,000 years later? But she didn't do it for that reason. She didn't do it for the grams, you know. She didn't do it so that we'd talk about it. She did it because she wanted to serve Jesus. But as we finish, I do want to say that I think, for those of you who do follow Jesus, I think I have a small inkling of some of the pressure you are under. The other day, myself and three other lawyers were walking down Martin Place early in the morning. We'd just been to a prayer meeting, okay? And we saw this lady. She was standing in the middle of Martin Place, and she had this banner. It was like this: Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life. That verse there, John 14:6, right? There she's standing, all alone, just quietly, in the middle of Martin Place. People are kind of walking past. And I stopped. One of the guys I was with said, "Oh, my goodness, is someone going to stone her?" And my heart started beating because, you know, I'm thinking, well, that's a bit narrow, isn't it? I mean, that probably offends the city council inclusiveness policy to say that. There's no other way but Jesus. Well, if you want to ask me what I did, I can tell you later. But now, for many of you, you daily face this pressure, this dilemma. Should I speak out or should I remain silent, don't you? I mean, what do you do? My heart goes out. Your heart begins to beat and you kind of get all sweaty. Well, I do anyway, and you kind of don't know what to do. I mean, what if it means if you lose your job? What then? I mean, the isolation, the loneliness, the shame that you can feel can be almost crushing. And I actually know that some of you have had to bear the brunt of incredibly ordinary treatment because of your stand for Jesus. And I think you are the true heroes of faith in the 21st century. We're not told explicitly. So the question was, in case you didn't get it, what happened to Lazarus? Well, we're not told explicitly. We presume he died a natural death again. Jesus is completely different because when he rose, he rose forever. So, yeah. We don't know, but that's part of what we'll be looking at the next 2 weeks. You'll notice if you read the end of chapter 11, it's because of Lazarus' resurrection that the chief priest actually launched the judicial plot to kill Jesus. So he is a significant figure. So in chapter 11, 45, it says, "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him." So that's the positive thing. I mean, a lot of people, it was an outstanding miracle, and a lot of people began to follow Jesus. And next week, when we look at the pursuit of glory, we'll see some of that group in the crowd that welcomed Jesus into Jerusalem, right? But that's not all to say on that. But then the next bit, but, verse 46, some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done, so they told tales. Then the chief priests and the Sanhedrin called a meeting. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, and at that meeting they determined that they would kill him. So yeah, it's a turning point in John's gospel, and the tension, the drumbeat begins to pound from this point onwards.
Other question.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. If you look down the bottom, Lachlan's included a little double star footnote. Note from the speaker, verse 7 could also be translated, "Jesus replied, 'Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial.'" It's a little bit tricky to work out exactly what John means at this point. The difficulty is that it seems that Mary has poured out all the perfume, right? She's anointed Jesus' feet and possibly his whole body with it. So to say she has kept it for the burial doesn't sort of make sense of the flow of the passage. So that's why I think it's best to see that it's actually referring to the fact that, you know, she wanted to honour Jesus by doing this, so she's doing it for his burial. So that's probably the best way of reading it. It's a very, very good question.
One that came up earlier was, you know, is it wrong for Christians then to actually pursue high up positions? You know, can they climb Everest, be a CEO, be Prime Minister, or is it, you know, better to aim for Kilimanjaro, just MP, you know?
Or K2.
Yeah.
Or K2 is just as dead, actually, more so. That's a really, really great question. So it's a difficult one to answer, but I think it has to do with mindset. I think Mary here sees how wonderful Jesus is, and just he's so powerful and so loving and so kind, and so she devotes herself, body and soul, to him, and that's what we should do as well. Jesus is just absolutely brilliant. The way that if you read the New Testament, if you're not kind of used to these accounts of Jesus' life, just as you read them, you just get so drawn to the person of Jesus, who is just so loving and kind, and who would give his life for us. He's just extraordinary. So I think the way to think about it, Lachlan, is I think we devote ourselves to Jesus, body, mind and soul, and God will do with us whatever he wants. It may be for some that, like, say, Wilberforce, who was a young man who became a Christian in his early 20s, and you know, John Newton said, you know, he went to John Newton to say, look, should I continue to pursue politics or not? John Newton, the writer of Amazing Grace, said, no, stay in politics and serve God in that chosen field, which he did. And as we know, he, you know, outlawed slavery in the British Empire and so on. But extraordinarily, it was William Wilberforce who ensured that a Bible-believing chaplain was on the First Fleet, Richard Johnson. And so we are sitting here today in Sydney, in a city which is literally littered with churches that believe the Bible, that teach the Bible, that we've had exposure to the Bible because of the act of that man, William Wilberforce, in the 1730s, right, or 1740s. So I think our chief ambition should be the glory of God, And God may have us lead a very humble and quiet life in all obscurity, but then we don't know, do we? Because you think about Mary, as I said, she didn't do this act to try and get a, you know, for the grams, right, to get a selfie of it, did she? She did this act out of her devotion to the Lord Jesus, and here we are 2,000 years later still speaking about it. So I think in another sense, Lachlan, perhaps we need to suspend judgment just because the world tells us this person is great or not. In heaven, we're going to see people with crowns that you would not believe. You know, the humble servant who the 80-year-old who's like my granny, for example, if I can use her as an example. She, with her friends, used to meet every Thursday at a little church and pray for people. We called her Camel Knees because she was always praying. Maybe, who knows? You know, maybe her prayers have wrought more good in the world than anything. So I think we need to have a little bit of humility in terms of we don't really know what's going to affect the kingdom of God in the greatest way. But I think if we desire it, that is the right approach.
Cool, thank you. Well, before you head off on the microphone, we've got you back again next week, which you alluded to earlier.
Yes.
The pursuit of glory. Can you tell us about what are we looking at next week?
Yeah. Well, so some of the crowd who were actually there at this dinner and saw Lazarus actually begin to follow Jesus on the road into Jerusalem. So we're going to follow along beside this crowd and just see what happens on the pursuit of glory.
Okay, fantastic.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.